Today, the drought is officially over. That's right, we're going to be talking about Daredevil Born Again Season 2, Episode 1, giving our first impressions and why I felt like this was a pretty good return to Matthew Murdock in all his glory. Let's get going.
Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, hosted by me, Robbie Earl, and by my longtime friend from work, Kyle Schoenwill. Kyle, you know that the moment this episode opened with some in-costume Daredevil fighting...
Which is what you were wanting.
It's all I wanted. We bookended it. We opened it. We ended it. It was just, and then everything in between was this great kind of like Sopranos drama. It was everything for everyone. I was all about it. I'm very happy right now.
Isn't it funny how much we talked about that in the saga so far and our mailbag episode about how it would just be nice to be back in Daredevil world where he's Daredevil. He's not ashamed of it. And he's just fighting crime. And you got it in the first 30 seconds.
And full like suit the suit looks so cool. And I keep saying that right now because we are coming off of the Brand New Day trailer where the suit also looks so cool. But man, it's like they're giving us some stuff right now.
No doubt. I think for me, from a high level, there were two or three times in the episode I texted you this where I went, woo! It just like from a high level, it really felt like we're kind of back on track. Now, you and I both really liked Daredevil Born Again Season 1.
Yeah.
But when I was going back and making the clips for our videos and stuff, I was reminded there are some things about it that I was left feeling unsettled. And this felt like cohesion. This felt like this was the target they were going for and they nailed it. So it just felt like to me, I texted you, prestige television. Now, I'm not saying it's Severance or any of that, but just my overall takeaway was there's nothing that you could complain about that you're not getting from a Daredevil show. Like acting, visuals, cinematography, pacing, the story, it's all there. So you either like Daredevil or you don't, and I like it. Yeah. And so like it just felt like a great return to form.
Yeah, I do think that that's one of the tough things with this show in particular. You are still doing a superhero show. Even more, by the way, than something like Loki that we've talked about recently, which is also like season two was Benson and Moorhead and we loved it. But that's not really a superhero show. Like it's kind of more just general sci-fi. And so they can make it a tad more Severance-y. And you don't necessarily need to have these, like you don't have hardly any like battles or fights or anything. And
that's right.
There's a world where in something like Daredevil, and this is probably things like this happened a lot like 15 years ago in the kind of 2000s era of making superhero projects where it's like we're going to try to drain all of that out of it and just make it like all of the drama and barely any of the superhero stuff because we're a little embarrassed by it and we don't want to like look like we're making a cartoon for kids. This is adult television.
That's right.
So it's a tricky balance. And that's why I was so impressed with the balance here, because I do think that you're right. Like if you like Daredevil, if you want like a kind of equal parts in Jurisprudence and like him out at night as Daredevil, kind of as the secret vigilante, actually doing the like acrobatics and the like fight style stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else you would look for than what we got here.
It's a great point because Netflix Daredevil season one really shies away from the superhero stuff almost the entire time. I mean, most of the time he's just wearing a mask essentially that's homemade and he's wearing black and just beating people up. But there's no batons, there's no flying or swinging or any kind of acrobatics. And then, you know, in Daredevil Born Again season one, if we felt like they tried it and it was really cool, but it still hadn't fully settled into how do you take this character that is so grounded and gritty, but still make him a superhero, feels like through one episode, they nailed it here. Just starting with the intro fight and whatnot. And So I think tonally, that's the right call for sure. And I can't wait to get into it. Here's the fun thing about today, Robbie. This is all kind of from your brain, which I love. Kyle and Robbie at Friends From Work are a little bit returning to form, OG form, in how we used to structure these podcast episodes. So we're not going to talk about how we structured every week, but because of the first week we're trying it, we're going to go back to some segments as we're breaking down these episodes of television. So what you're going to see is what we just gave was what we're calling our first impressions. We're going to try to start every episode with just like our gut overall reaction. How do you feel about what you watched? Then we're going to slide into a segment called Friendly Feedback, which longtime listeners will know and recognize as what worked and what didn't work. A return to form, OG. And so I'll explain each segment as we get there. So let's, you know, without further ado, let's get into our friendly feedback, what worked and what didn't work. Be sure to check out our friends at Panelbound Comics, panelboundcomics.com, formerly Organic Price Books. So if you're a longtime listener, you'll recognize both of those names. Panelbound Comics has been the exclusive comic book provider to Friends From Work for years now, and we love it. They got a ton of fun stuff going. If you go over there right now and use our promo code FRIENDSFROMWORK, you get a discount on already discounted comics, which is pretty incredible. That's where Robbie and I have been going through all of the Marvel Comics 101 and the Comics Corner stuff on Friends From Work Plus, and we're getting all of our comic books from there, including my Daredevil comic that I mailed to a friendly listener a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and we've said it before, I'll say it again, it is pretty hard to beat Daredevil when it comes to comic source material. I think that a lot of people have said rightly that they're the most consistently good Marvel comics in the history of Marvel comics. And the shows have done such a great job of adapting those. And right now, Panelbound Comics has a crazy stock of stuff from kind of all through the eras that are being pulled from for Born Again. So it's a great time to check them out.
Promo code Friends From Work. Okay, Robbie, friendly feedback. What worked and what didn't work? I'm going to kick us off. One of my critiques from, honestly, the Netflix Daredevil, if you go back and watch it, this critique applies. And then it applied again in Born Again, season one. It applied when Daredevil showed up in Echo, is that I just don't always feel like the punches land. Meaning, if you really slowed it down, you can almost kind of tell that they are swinging at someone's face and then the person's reacting to it, but it's not actually hitting them. And I'm not a filmmaker. I don't know the tricks behind that, like how you get away with beating someone up literally. But especially like in the bar fight scene in episode one of Born Again one, it's complex to talk about. There's so many different ones in season
Born
ones.
Born Again.
But in the beginning of the first bar scene, like they are not hitting each other clearly. And I understand why, but the choreography of it looks like it's pulling punches, even though it's not supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they mostly figured that out here. So in general, I want to start with huge props to the choreography of the fight scenes. And I don't know all the behind the scenes. Listeners can chime in here. My understanding is that they actually did bring in somebody else to choreograph the fights that I think did some of the original Netflix stuff. Now, but again, just hear me out. I got to say this at the very top of this season. I am not a person that thinks all of the Netflix stuff is untouchable and everything they did was perfect. And then everything that Disney tries to do is bad. I am not that person. I think there are some improvements in Born Again over the Netflix stuff. And I think a lot of that is nostalgia for people. If you go back and watch some of it, there are some slow sections of the Netflix stuff. There are some punches that are being pulled. There are some things that look funny. There are some chemistry things that are off. And that's from someone who loves all of it. But just know that's not, so that's the foundation, okay? That being said, I think they brought in that guy and someone fact checked me if that's who it was. But man, it really has a tangible difference to me. Even from the get-go when he walks in, throws his, what do you want to call them, batons? Is that what you're going to call them?
Yeah.
Throws them at their face. Like it feels like it's actually hitting them. When he swipes the leg of someone, it feels like it has enough momentum to actually trip the person, not that they're then flipping after they're getting touched, if that makes sense.
Right.
And in general, I'll talk about the cinematography in a second, but how that's all framed from an action standpoint, including the end of the episode, when the attack on Cherry's apartment happens.
Yo, yeah, man.
It's all just choreographed well. So again, we're going to get into the cinematography of it in a second, but just thankful for that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I felt the same way. Like I remember in general, there were parts of the opening of season one that I was just a little like unsure about. Like I liked what it was doing plot-wise. I liked how quickly we got into it, but there were things that just felt a little jarring. And I do remember a lot of conversations about the quality of that action or choreography. And yeah, I didn't feel that at all here. I also loved how like Batman Begins it was.
Like, yeah.
It was it felt almost like that, like an intentional nod in that you kind of had this level of like, there was a mystery and a fear around Daredevil kind of striking out from the shadows that I think really leaned into him having the new black suit too. Like it kind of showed you that there's a new persona. Like it's the total opposite end of the spectrum of like the yellow She-Hulk,
yeah,
Daredevil.
Yeah.
And it added some menace to it.
The captains are aware of him. Oh, yeah. It's the devil. It's the devil from Hell's Kitchen. And then Fisk looks at it and immediately says, this is a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like a dread almost of it's that guy.
And like him looking in the camera.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's that opening sequence when he like bends the guy's arm back.
My wife was immediately mad at the show. My wife was immediately out that I didn't prep her for that.
It's like 45 seconds in.
Yeah. First thing.
Which, you know, I mean, at this point, if you watch season one and got through the head smashing, then I guess that there's nothing they can do to top that.
That's one thing we used to always joke about. In the first three seasons of the Netflix Daredevil, it is gratuitously violent. Mm-hmm. Head smashing, guys getting shot everywhere, but they don't ever use bad language.
Yeah.
Ever. There's not a single curse word essentially in the whole thing. It's kind of interesting because now that they're on Disney, they've actually found like a happy medium. There was probably five F words here.
Yeah, yeah.
And the violence is maybe not as intense. It's maybe like, so it's like they found the middle ground kind of like, oh yeah, we can kiss too. And, and talk about sex.
That, I mean, it is interesting to note that though, because other than Deadpool and Wolverine, is this the first time we've ever had?
There's that one F word in Guardians 3, remember? That was like a big deal.
Yeah.
It's just that Netflix stuff, they didn't do anything with sex, with language, but then we're going to blow everybody's head off.
I know.
Then here it's like, now it's going to find in the middle ground. But anyways, like visually, Robbie, on that, again, as someone who loved Born Again season one, there were some things like in the first episode where they're on the rooftop of the bar. And my radar's up going, man, I wish they would just go to a bar and film it on the top of a bar.
Yeah.
It clearly looks like the background is blue screened. And then the behind the scenes released, and that's the case, right? They're on a structure they built, but the whole thing is blue in the background. I could be getting tricked here. You know, technology is getting better and better.
Right.
But I just thought it looked so good. I even love the shot of Ariel over the bridge with the ship coming underneath the bridge.
Yeah, I thought
like,
that. Yeah.
So I don't know if they got a real ship. If that's all CGI, it looks awesome. It looks like they actually got Fisk and his team to go to a bridge in New York and overlook the river.
Mm-hmm.
And then even if they CGI'd the ship in there, I don't have any of the visual concerns through one episode that I had with Born Again season one and some of the volume stuff that happens with Disney.
Yeah.
I don't have any of that here. And again, I'm always the let's shoot it on location guy.
Right.
Because it feels like they're doing some of that. It does feel like the cinematography was up a notch. Like, did you see in that first attack, when one of the workers in the boat is looking for him, it's very like, you know, Batman Begins. You get that one visual of his head silhouetted in the light before he then jumps out. And then obviously Benson and Moorhead's use of color, like they're obsessed with that. Like when Bullseye shows up in Born Again, it gets like very blue, you know, when he's having that buzzing thing. There's some red with Daredevil. Same here. Like when they're in the boat, it's almost extreme. And we saw this in Loki as well. But there's some cool shots when he's like looking behind the crates, and it's very, it's got a very hue color tint, you know? Yeah. And they do that all the time. Like even yeah. Matt's apartment that they're hiding out in behind Josie's is very stylized mm-hmm. color wise. And I just think it's all fun and a step up.
Yeah. And kind of comic book saturated. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I thought that like all of, again, all of the action stuff, I think is definitely what worked for me. I think something else that worked that I'm excited to kind of see play out is the way that they're sort of laying the foundation for these vigilante trials as the, like, I mean, one of the things that I thought yes. was so great about season two of Daredevil was like the period where you have them defending Frank, Matt and Foggy defending Frank in court after Daredevil has been fighting Frank as the Punisher. And it's just such a, like, I thought for that moment, and then season two kind of goes off the rails, but for that moment, it was a really great way of balancing the Matt Murdock and Daredevil sides of his world. And so kind of seeing that here again, I was a little worried at points with Born Again that they didn't quite know, like, you know, you have like the swordsman reference, but you also have like Kamala Khan's dad, and you're not totally sure how much of that is like an artifact of a version of the show that was just leaning more into the MCU. And then they came in and wanted to pull it a little bit back more towards like the Netflix roots. And when that happens, I get instinctively nervous that they're just going to be dangling threads that are kind of left. But what a great way to use Tony Dalton's character here.
Jack Duquesne.
It's like, it's still in line, I think, with a lot of what we got in Hawkeye. It's obviously a lot more serious, but it doesn't feel like that much of a left turn.
He feels like he's playing it similarly, which is great.
More, even more so, I would say, than season one, where he's kind of got this sort of like he's untouchable. He's a little bit like not quite oblivious, but sort of.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that like the moment when he realizes that like he doesn't have control in this situation the way that he normally does, and the conversation with Heather. Mm-hmm. Like I think that that all played well, but it just gives like a really nice framework for the season. And I don't know how long they're going to have that going. And obviously Matt is not doing the courtroom side of it, at least currently, because he's in hiding.
Right. But they're talking about missing it.
Yeah. And I just think it also sets up some interesting stuff that has happened in the comics. Like we talked about last season with the Charles Soule run. Charles is an attorney and a criminal attorney, and did a lot of really interesting stuff with kind of this fictional case law around how you would deal with masked vigilantes. And it seems like they're setting that up. Mm-hmm. And I think that all of that kind of like, there are points where it basically, it became in his world, he sort of built a foundation for it to be legal to kind of accept, this like costumed identity as a person in itself or in his or herself. And so you have a situation where Matt is actually testifying in court as Daredevil, not as Matt Murdock. And I wonder if they're going to start playing with some of the things there. But either way, I just think it's, I think it's really important to a Daredevil story to never totally stray from the kind of courtroom side of it, because that is one of the things that makes him unique. And that's something that we didn't get hardly any of, for instance, in season three, which I love season three, but like because of what is going on with Matt there.
And you really liked that from Born Again season one, that we got more of that.
Yeah.
One last thing on the Jack Duquesne case. I'm with you. I have no idea if that's going to drive the whole show, or is that like Born Again season one where Hector Ayala was just a part of it, you know, and there's kind of like three chapters of it. I'm thinking it's going to drive most of the show.
Yeah.
And I love that because I spent so much time last week talking about how this is going to be the ode to Netflix. And I do think that's the case, but I really appreciate that right off the get-go, they give us the MCU-ness of it with like Jack Duquesne being a tying figure. So again, they may not do anything more than that and whatever, but it feels like, well, this is a perfect transition because you also got a Val reference.
Yeah.
So I was thankful that right away, I'm centered as an MCU fan on what's going on in New York, which that's my other big takeaway of what worked. I loved the introduction of Mr. Charles here and I love the practical, my brain's always going to the practical. Like if this is real, how would this happen? Because tiny tangent, you were just talking about the courtroom thing. Part of me is like, I understand how in the comics that all works so perfectly. My brain goes, in real life, if this could happen, I think it'd be really hard for Matt to have all three things for a long time. Be a lawyer that's actually functional and successful while also going out and stopping crime at night and then also having no one know who he is. Like at some point, my practical brain's like, people would figure this out or, you know, there would be problems. He's not getting enough sleep. He's, you know, he's beating up someone he shouldn't have beat, whatever. So I like that they're kind of messing with that. And like the Charles Soule thing seems like that's a, that's kind of like an extreme endpoint of what I'm talking about. Like at some point, there's a breaking point here. It can't all just exist.
Right.
Which is also why I'm okay with him not being a lawyer just at this given second.
Yeah.
What was I saying? Tangent. Oh, Val being brought in. I thought that, was it Matthew Lillard?
Yeah.
Did a great job with Mr. Charles.
Yeah.
And I like the practical point of, you know, Fisk is pulling this all off as mayor in New York. Now, keep in mind, he's not governor. He's not president of America. He's a mayor. And he's pulling all this stuff off. There would eventually be repercussions, I would think, or at least check-ins from higher-ups. Governors, secretary of state, whatever. At some point, they'd be like, but I like that they're setting up that to the public, it's kind of going well-ish to some people. And then two, that, there's another guy from Langley who does get brought in. And he has Val's contact on hold. So like he's up at that level and they are then corrupt enough to clear it to where I like that scene of the governor being like, you have our full support and leaving. I just think, thank you for addressing the practical ramifications, not to mention Lillard being a foil to Fisk's rigidity, you know, him just being like leaning back, being like, so are you going to kill him or do I talk to the missus now or what? And then being offended by that, but also realizing they need that partnership. I just think it's a great character addition. And I think it's a great practical plot addition.
I know. And we'll talk a little bit more about the, like the kind of wider MCU of all this in a bit. Cause I'm kind of curious to talk through some of that with you, but I agree. I loved that moment. And I thought like, I wasn't really sure who Matthew Lillard was going to be playing or what that character would bring, but I you know, he's kind of bringing a little bit of what I think he has done well consistently, you know, for two decades of kind of genre projects where he's the slightly unhinged guy. But here there's also this kind of quiet control there I mean, one of the things that that the Chip Zdarsky run did so well that they started to pull in in the end of season one is this idea that like Fisk has always been the scariest guy in the room. He's always been the most powerful guy in the room and normally the richest guy in the room. But once he becomes mayor of New York, he's now kind of, he's operating in a different world. Like he's going from like big fish in a little pond to like a, you know, still big fish, but in a much bigger pond. And you see this, like there are people that are so much wealthier than him. You kind of have these like Koch brother type folks that are involved once you get into like national pot. I mean, you know, you look at like even how big of a deal the mayoral race in New York was in real life over the last year. Like,
it's why they ultimately don't want him to be the mayor, I think. Ultimately, I think this will end. Because I think they want to move him back to the shadow. I think things become more and more difficult to explain when he's the mayor and has that kind of elevated platform. Like the corruption would have to be so deep
Yeah.
And again, they're showing it, like I'm saying. But just as a side note, that's why I think it's eventually going that direction.
But I do, like, I thought that kind of power struggle there between him and Vanessa and Mr. Charles was a great way of showing that, where, like, at the end of the day, like, he does sort of cave by the end of it because he knows that he doesn't really have the leverage in that situation. Like, he doesn't have anything on Mr. Charles.
Interests are aligned.
Yeah. Like, and you also kind of see Vanessa
and he does this.
Struggling with that. Yeah.
You notice that he always does with his fingers on the table.
I thought that was great as well. And I'm glad that you brought up the New York piece, because that's another thing that I thought was handled well here, is the, like, the B.B. Urich, like, that video that I guess she's making kind of in cooperation with the Fisk administration. And then this, like
the positively spun one.
The positive one, yeah. And the tone of that being, like, so over the top, like, kind of cheesy, where it opened with it. And for a moment, you're like, oh, like, this is, like, this feels off in a way where I was a little worried about, like, the tone of the show for a second before I realized how much they were just, like, leaning into the kind of propaganda piece of that. And even the reveal of, you know, like, the graffiti, like, behind him that then, like, cuts it off.
Like, oh, crap. And he, like, moves the camera.
And, but I thought that was a kind of a great job of like they accomplish a lot by doing that. They, one, sort of show what BB's role is currently and kind of how connected she is. They also show, like, how much the Fisk administration is working overtime on the propaganda front to kind of try to project this image. But then you also see, once it cuts to this other, like, you know, the Fisk mask person, like, you see that there is something else going on, that there's this understanding of, like, what's happening with the Fisk administration from, like, the ground level, like, grassroots. And that there's this, like, conversation about, like, whether BB is a shill for the administration. Like, I think that there's a lot that they get across there that makes, like I liked that segment in first season, but I don't know that we got a ton from it. But I think it kind of makes it worth it now to see them build on that and to start. Like, I'm curious to see where it goes, and, you know, maybe it doesn't pan out to anything interesting. But right now, I think that that's kind of an interesting thread.
No doubt. The last thing on the what worked and what didn't work for me front is I just love the ending. That was one of the reasons woo! But again, so first of all, the unpredictability of it. Cherry's in his house. You hear the knock on the door. You immediately assume, okay, he's getting in trouble. He assumes it, right? He already does this, knowing they're going to break the door down.
Yeah, which, by the way, I love their little, like, text, like, takeout code.
Yes. Yep. And that's their meetup, I'm assuming. Then he's getting tortured and beat. So again, it's emphasizing that the punches feel like they're landing, including this torture scene. The cops originally are like, Cherry, we don't have to do this, because remember, he's a retired detective, so he probably knows these people. And now it's showing the corruption of how deep this runs, that even people he used to know are like, we're going to come in and we're going to maybe even kill you. Then Matthew comes in and saves the day with, again, the action looking awesome to me as he's beating all those dudes up. He then is traumatized, which we need to talk about this, because it seems like they're going to hint at this or play with this idea of all these people being traumatized by their past. He hears the heartbeat of Cherry, who maybe is having a heart attack, is my understanding. But then hears Foggy's heartbeat in his nightmares, which causes him to get distracted and he gets beat up. Side note, because Heather also has that with Muse. She is seeing Muse, which, again, I love. You were just saying this with BB. It feels like a tie-up instead of, or it feels like a growth from the things they set in season one,
right,
and not like running away from. Like, one of the critiques of Daredevil Born Again season one was that all the side characters didn't have a lot of autonomy. Like, what was the point of having all these people in there? And now, and I've read this in some of the reviews, which we'll get to in a little bit later, that some people were really praising that now all of those other characters had more of a role. And I think we're already seeing that. Like, there's already some growth between him and Cherry, between him and Kirsten.
Yeah, Kirsten's going to have a huge role here, I think.
The DA, which I'm blanking on his name, who's now, like, been bought out by Fisk, essentially. Yeah. But then, like, also the flashbacks to Muse, the flashbacks to Foggy. And then what I'm trying to get at is they start pulling his mask off, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, are we already going to get rid of the identity thing? We've hidden the identity. Well, then they actually pull it all the way off. Like, for a second, I thought maybe they're not going to get it, you know, I don't know. They're going to get it halfway up his face, and then it's going to end or something. So then they pull it off, and I'm thinking, oh no, does now Cherry kill these guys? Because, like, maybe Cherry grabs a gun, because now he's like, we can't have this be thing.
But and part of me was like, well, maybe they don't immediately recognize him, you know, like, but then they're immediately like, oh, it's Matt Murdock.
Holy crap, it's Matthew Murdock.
Yeah.
And then they put a gun to his head. Like, okay, we're going to just kill him now. And then all these shots fly in, guys die. Yeah. And then just this one knife that says, you're welcome, was so cool to me.
Yeah.
And now I'm, again, so intrigued by this character who has, Bullseye has had a weird run. But now I don't know what he's trying to do because he didn't kill Matt. Right. So he's intentionally keeping Matt alive. I have chills right now for some reason.
Yeah.
We also don't know why he's saving Matt's life or Cherry's life or killing these cops. Is he just on a rage fest against Fisk? And he knows that Daredevil is anti-Fisk as well. So there's no point in killing him. I just think there's going to be some more complexity there.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see Wilson
Bethel.
So anyways, I love the ending.
If he is, I know. Yeah. I loved it for a couple of reasons. To tie that up, I like that even if Bullseye is still, he's still, like, you know, sociopathic or whatever, he doesn't have any good intentions, but he is just anti-Fisk because of the Fisks screwing him over, then he would want to keep Daredevil, he would want to help Daredevil as much as he can just because it's going to make Fisk's life harder. So you could, like, that makes sense to me. I don't know if that's his motivation, but that would make sense. I also loved it because, again, it's like one of the things that Daredevil has done well, even through the Netflix stuff, is kind of grounded in him still being a normal person, essentially, when it comes to his, like, physical, like, endurance. You know, like, he's not a normal person when it comes to, like, his senses.
Right. There was a lot of that in the Netflix show and not a ton of that in Born Again 1.
Right. Well, and, you know, in part, we just didn't get a ton of him. I mean, it took halfway through the season before he suited up. But
to watch him take some punches, fall to the ground.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's like all it takes is him to lose focus. You know, like, because that's the difference between, like, Spider-Man or Captain America or these other people
Hulk.
Well, but even like in, but, you know, not quite to the Hulk or Thor level. It's like, you know, if Spider-Man, like, gets distracted and takes a hit, it doesn't really matter if it's just a normal person.
I see.
But for Matt, it does. Like, it's like all it takes is for him to, like, lose, like, to get out of the moment, and then now it's 3-on-1 and he's a guy and he can't quite recover. And I liked that. Like, I think that keeps the stakes, like, always present. Like, you always feel like he's one, like, missed punch away from getting overtaken, because he's always going to be the underdog in these scenarios, which I think also sets up the need for him to have, like, a greater network and, like, an army of other vigilantes, whether that's Jessica Jones or whoever else.
Which, by the way, I did catch, my wife actually caught on the, we watched the screener twice. So I watched it once by myself, and then I watched the first episode again with Annika. And did you know that with subtitles, it's really fast, but Karen says, I'll text Jess.
Oh no.
When they're going over it. So she says, I'll get Jess on it, or I'll text Jess, or Jess is looking into it.
And then moves interesting.
On. And with subtitles on, it's Jess. I mean, which is not a spoiler. We know that's coming, but just kind of cool that they're already working it in. It's not going to be, like, brought in as some, you know, ringer at the end. It's no, she's already a part of the team.
I thought about rewatching it again. And then I realized that I think what I'm going to do is rewatch it when it's live ahead
now while you're listening.
and then I'm excited to kind of get on schedule with everybody. The only things that I would say, again, I I was really happy with this as the start, and it's really hard to make any real judgment calls until you move forward. There were a few of the moments, like with like Karen and BB, that didn't quite click for me, like where it just felt a little maybe like not bad, and in a lot of ways it felt like the OG Netflix stuff, and so maybe that's like when we've gone through that stuff, those are some of the parts of those shows that don't work as well for me. But just like as Karen starts kind of talking about what happened with her and Ben, it just felt a little forced recappy to me. But I also get why they had to do it and why they needed to kind of like more clearly connect her and BB. But that was like one of the only moments that like I clocked as not being quite like to the sort of prestige level that I felt like the rest of the episode was.
You know what? So you're going to hear this in my grade. I think I agree in general. Again, if you're just finding this podcast, we like to focus on the positive and let people enjoy things. My only note is, and it's less specific than yours, is I just don't think Karen's my favorite character. At this point, yeah. I have watched 3 seasons of Karen. That's 13 episodes. You know, we're talking 40 hours of Karen. And then she got brought back in Daredevil Born Again season 1. So at this point, and now they're empowering her, right? Because one of the critiques was that Karen as a character, not Deborah Ann Woll, but the character was always needing to be saved and kind of help us. So then they kind of like give her an elevated role at the Bulletin and a journalistic thing. And then in season 1 of Born Again, she's the one that calls Frank. And so she's kind of helping. And now she's like physically fighting and wearing wigs. And like they're fully on a team, which I kind of appreciate. It's a good next step as far as we've done the other side of it. Like, who's Matt? What's he doing? Yeah. Why can't I know? Or like, it makes sense that Matt now would just trust her to help. Reminds me of Spider-Man and MJ in the video game.
Yeah.
Where finally she has some autonomy to do stuff. But like MJ in the video game, with all that being said, I'm not trying to be rude. I just don't think I enjoy Karen that much.
Yeah.
And I like BB, but I'm with you in that scene. Like when Karen's like getting, I said to Annika, and this is so rude. I'm not trying to be mean. It just feels like every line when either Deborah Ann Woll delivering it or the way it's written is always so emotional or so heavy. Like, it's always like, I think the best thing to do is to not die. To honor them. I'm like, at some point I'm ready for Karen to have a normal conversation, which is so mean.
Yeah.
That's so mean. I think she's going to be great this season, but yes, I'm with you. It's not my favorite part. And again, that's more of a preference, not crushing her. That's just as a preference. It's not my favorite character.
Well, in a way, I think that that's one of the things where I think I did like her role in Born Again, and I don't just mean the fact that she wasn't there for most of the season. I mean the parts where she was, it seemed like she was a little more like,
that's fair.
I don't know if detached is the right word, but it's like she came in and she kind of felt like she wasn't like
so dependent on Matt and that whole world or something.
Yeah, like it, and she kind of came in and saved Matt by calling Frank, and all of that felt really natural. And then here,
I think that she moved away on her own. Like, I don't need this. I liked, kind of. Not because she wasn't on camera, but
I've kind of got a, this is I don't even know if it's a trope, but something that often happens in these superhero stories is like, as you kind of have side characters that become more comfortable and familiar with the superhero world, they kind of take on this role that doesn't feel super natural or realistic. Like it's one thing for Jess or even Cherry, who's like an ex-cop, to be comfortable in that world, but it doesn't feel like I don't like the scene where she and Matt, like it makes sense that he would be kind of training her, but it also is like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if this feels quite right. To me,
I 100% agree with you. I will ease both of our consciences by saying I don't think they're going to do that. Like, I think that's just like a self-defense, like she's staying in shape. Great. I would be shocked if this is like, you know, she's jumping over cars with a gun and like, you know, I don't think that's going to happen, but I totally agree with you.
I, But yeah, I mean, and I think you're right. And that's just, I think in general, we're on the same page in that I'm curious, like, sometimes I think that fans of the Daredevil show on Netflix are similar to like fans of like Spider-Man comics, and that they are so, a lot of people get real focused on like these original relationships. And so for people in the comics, it's like gotta be Peter and Mary Jane. And if it's not, it's because like Marvel Comics is like personally offending them. And here, I feel like there's a little bit of that, you know, with like the classic Karen Matt Foggy. And Karen thing. And I just think it's interesting. And you've kind of made this, you made this point in Born Again, and I wasn't as on board with it at the time, that maybe Karen and Frank is actually a better dynamic if we're doing that.
And I'm right, right?
I think you're right. I think you're right. Because I'm watching
feel,
it this
it
episode.
It doesn't feel natural when they kiss. It's like,
no.
You're friends.
It doesn't feel like, it didn't feel.
It didn't work in Netflix either when they had that little face. And that was part of the fun of the drama, is when it's not working and right. He's seeing other people. And here's the other thing too, is like, it's kind of funny because Daredevil at his core is kind of a womanizer and has a bunch of girlfriends. And so it feels a little bit weird for him to be like locked down in a very, I don't know. I wonder if it needs to be a little more like Pepper to Tony in the early like Iron Man 1 stuff. Kind of thing.
Yeah, but, I don't feel that's such a great call out in terms of the immediate chemistry. Even when they weren't romantic, you kind of just like, you loved watching scenes with Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow. And I just don't get that feeling with Charlie Cox and Deborah Ann Woll.
No. And she's better with Frank. So as a positive, I saw Deborah Ann Woll, the premiere was last night in New York. And she talks about stuff almost kind of hinting that she's aware that there are people that ship Frank and Karen, which, by the way, I guess is called Castle with a K. Karen Castle.
Okay, that's Castle. Yeah, sure.
Okay, it's okay. Anyways, I just get the sense that it's not maybe 100% over. But in the meantime, I'm with you. I just don't think it's very natural when the two of them are together. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Your mental health is so important, guys. And I know what it feels like when some days feel good, other days feel overwhelming. Sometimes it's hard for me to sleep. There are things that keep me up at night. There are things that distract me. I have friends going through all kinds of hard stuff, divorce, sickness, job loss, and yet other days feel really great where things just seem to really be going your way. But the truth is, no journey should be done alone. Having someone walk through all of that with you, to listen, to understand, and to support you, can make all the difference in the world. Well, this month of May is an opportunity to check in with yourselves and understand where you're at right now. It's Mental Health Awareness Month. There's never been a better time. And if you're feeling overwhelmed, stuck, anxious, or unsure, it's okay to acknowledge that, and it's okay to have those feelings. They're more common than you think, and you don't have to navigate them alone. BetterHelp is here to help. BetterHelp is online therapy, and they have therapists that work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed within the United States. They do all the matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up now and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. All right, so here's a segment that we're going to be calling Just Following Up. And it's basically just when we used to do, how does this affect the greater MCU? Are there any larger picture details that we missed? Now, in this specific case, I don't think this segment needs to be very long because there's really only a couple of references. But I am, as I mentioned earlier, intrigued by, okay, so Val and Mr. Charles are in some relationship together. It does clearly show that Val is above Fisk at this given point, but it also shows that they may be working together, which I hadn't thought about like during the Thunderbolts era. I don't picture this idea that Val's aware of Fisk and what he's doing and the corruption, and she's okay with it. but that does intrigue me. So I do wonder the power dynamic there. And have we 100% confirmed the timeline of this? Is this happening at the same time that Val is working with Yelena?
Yeah, that was, well, two questions that I think come out of that. One, is this pre or post Thunderbolts? And two, as kind of part of that, and I just need to remember because I haven't seen Thunderbolts since it came out because I've been like working towards it in the rewatch. But I'm trying to remember like when that opens up, right? She's the head of the CIA and she's kind of going through these impeachment proceedings. Yeah. And then it ends with her having kind of resurrected the Avengers and kind of coming on out on the right side of that PR wise. So she's still the head of the CIA, but she's also kind of heading up this Avengers team, or is she no longer the head of the CIA because she's now doing this separate, like kind of private enterprise?
I can't remember if she's quote unquote the head of CIA. She's clearly the head of CIA in like Wakanda Forever.
Right.
If you remember. But I kind of, again, we need to watch Thunderbolts again. We love it so much. We're saving it for our rewatch. I thought she almost was elevated above that by the end of the movie. Like whatever that would be like.
Like almost like a
Secretary
new Nick Fury.
Of State. Or like a new Thaddeus Ross kind of ish.
Yeah, I mean,
like the role he was in, you know, something like that, because she spins it, you know, at the end, she spins it as this was her idea and therefore like saving her from the impeachment and the trials and stuff. But then remember, Yelena's like, we're not, you know, we own you. Like we can do whatever we want.
Yeah. It wouldn't make sense to me that you would be the head of the CIA and also be tied to the Avengers in that way. Yeah, like those
and,
seem
and
like
doing
like
PR moves for the Avengers.
Yeah.
That's my understanding is that she had kind of advanced up. I don't know what
that
means.
Yeah. Well, and she also talks about how like she wants to be unimpeachable. And so I think the idea being that she doesn't really want to be part of the US government in that same way because she doesn't want to be subject to accountability. So I think maybe it does make sense that she's like out of that, or at least like still associated with it, still in control over pieces of it, but maybe kind of more unofficially. But I guess I need to watch back and see. We probably have listeners that can confirm that. But
either way, the timeline matters a lot to me here.
Yeah.
And I guess it's not a deal breaker, I guess, if I find out it's one way or the other. But if our listeners chime in and tell me that this season takes place prior to Thunderbolts, I think I would like that even more. That this is all actually happening before Thunderbolts chronologically.
Yeah.
Just because then I think it's easier for me to wrestle with there's not an Avengers team still. So Fisk is able to pull this stuff off. There's no one there to help. Bucky running for senator, he's maybe still just kind of wrestling with that idea, or he's just like getting running with it and he's not tuned into what's happening here. And then at the end of this season, if it ends with Fisk no longer being mayor, then cue up Thunderbolts. Makes a ton of sense why in Thunderbolts you're not talking about Mayor Fisk and the anti-vigilante thing, because this all happened before. That seems to make more sense to me. If you put it after, I think it can still work, but you are then left with more headcanon in my mind of like, why would the Thunderbolts be stationed in New York and not mention anything about this campaign against them or people like them? Or why would Val be publicly supporting vigilantes of sorts, or trying to create her own while also working with Fisk? You can explain it. I'm not saying you can't. I just think it'd be easier if Born Again season two is prior to Thunderbolts.
And because when we were talking about this before and talking about different people that could kind of come alongside Matt, we talked about Kate Bishop because of the Fisk history that she has.
That's right.
But I was totally blanking on like the fact that Yelena knows who Fisk is, like, because she was when she was hired,
she was there.
You know, she's the one that shows the photo of Fisk and Kate's mom. So from her perspective, if she is now kind of in a position of power and she's trying to sort of turn a corner and she sees this, I feel like she's the kind of person that would want to do something about it, or at least like raise some red flags. Again,
I agree.
if we find out these are happening at the same time, I think that there are plenty of ways around it. The Avengers are the Avengers. They've got other stuff going on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think, I think I'm with you. I think it would make sense coming before. And it sounds like that's kind of part of what's been signaled ahead of this, whether that's ever confirmed.
And my only other large MCU takeaway is just what I said earlier with Jack Duquesne and with the Val reference. It doesn't seem like they're shying away from it. And then on the heels of the Brand New Day trailer with the mayor's assistant, I think her name is Sheila.
Yeah.
With Sheila being in the trailer, with the fact that Frank is in Brand New Day, which is very much a representation of this street level Daredevil world. With Charlie Cox and Vincent D'Onofrio recently doing press, even Vincent D'Onofrio publicly on Twitter making jokes about that insect with Spider-Man. He said that.
He's been interacting.
It just feels like we're heading the right direction. Vincent D'Onofrio literally last night on Twitter even said, quote, if Disney and Sony would ever get their S together, we could do it. Like, that feels to me like pretty bold to say, like, basically being like, everybody's ready for me to be in the Spider-Man movie.
It's just crazy. Like, it's just going to make you money. Like,
here's my hot take. I think it's already happening. And he's privy to this, but he's still not able to say it yet. I'm not saying he's in Brand New Day, but like the wheels are turning. Like, Daredevil could be in Brand New Day. Charlie Cox straight up said to Jimmy Kimmel, I think it was, no, I am not. And he's like, well, are you lying? He's like, I am not lying. I wouldn't tell you if I was lying, but I am not lying. Like, very Andrew Garfield.
Yeah.
But I just feel like there's an ace in like up their sleeve.
I mean, that's he's already been in a Spider-Man movie.
And as much as Vincent D'Onofrio wants to blame Sony and Disney for the rights thing, I get it's complicated. How do you explain these other things? Like, they are bringing other, like, there is crossover in other ways. So maybe the argument is like Sheila is an original character to Disney, and so that's why she can be in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that
the movie.
It's also,
but I think it's coming. I think they both, and also, by the way, one more thing. Did you see this? The second most viewed trailer in 24 hours, the second most ever for a 24-hour period, was Deadpool and Wolverine at 365 million views in the first 24 hours. The second most ever. Spider-Man had over 700 million views in 24 hours. We're talking double the second highest ever. That includes Star Wars. That includes anything.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that Sony and Marvel can't figure something out?
Well, yeah,
That's ridiculous. And I mean, it's like you're sitting on the single most valued property in the world.
Especially in an era where people are feeling a lack of like fan enthusiasm around a lot of franchises.
From Sony's perspective, it makes total sense. Don't sell it because you're making, look at the kind of money you make. But from Marvel's perspective, it makes total sense. Well, and by the way, Sony, you giving up the rights to Marvel Studios doing it is they're handling it so well that you're getting billion-dollar movies and investment returns because you're letting them run it. And from Marvel Studios' standpoint, it sucks that you don't get all that money, but it gets all of the attention and everyone looking at you. So just keep it going, like figure something out to get Fisk in the crossover.
My understanding of the deal, like the IP split there, is that Sony gets the movie rights to any character that originated in Spider-Man comics. So I think that's why you can't, although even then that's kind of confusing because.
What about like Tombstone?
Well, but like, yeah. I mean, I think that
would be. So they just licensed the rights to Marvel or to Disney to use Tombstone, you're saying? Because that's an original.
Well, but also that's a show, which is slightly different, I think. Like, I think like streaming television rights.
Tombstone's going to be in Brand New Day.
Yeah, but that's a Sony. That's what I'm saying. Like.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm saying.
So then why wouldn't, what is preventing Fisk then from being in Brand New Day?
Nothing. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I don't think anything. Unless I'm misunderstanding, because then I'm thinking, well, then
And there's no way that Disney's like, no, we don't want Fisk. There's no way they're
saying
that.
I'm just wondering like how Fox was able to use Fisk in the OG Daredevil movie.
Let's send our lawyers on it.
I know. I'm going to have to dig
in. The point is, we don't fully understand. Going back to the greater MCU, we don't fully understand the rights. I don't fully understand it. I feel like it's a partnership that's really working. So hopefully they can figure something out. But here's my hot take as it affects the greater MCU. I think it's coming. I think it's all coming. It feels more. One episode of this show, to me, given all the press around it, felt more tied into everything than the entire season did last year, essentially. Like, I already feel like, okay, I know where we're heading. It's probably because of the Spider-Man movie, but I just think, like, it's happening.
It does. Yeah, my final note here, I think as much as it was feeling this way in season one, you know, I'm curious to see where things end, but right now it feels like this show is going to like raise a lot of questions as to like where Spider-Man is, just because the Brand New Day trailer is showing us that he's been very active in New York as this like masked vigilante. And that's been going on for, you know, the 4 years between No Way Home and whenever Brand New Day picks up. So I think like any way you slice it, he's been operating during this period as a vigilante. We did get the reference.
Probably
from
the most vigilante. Literally a guy wearing a full mask who has powers, who is just stopping crime. That's exactly what Fisk is against.
Like, and again, you know, whatever they do with this now, given the identity magic, but like Daredevil was already in No Way Home, so there's already a little bit of a connection. There was the little reference from Fisk in season one. Mm-hmm. I just like, even just a few little shout outs, like however like oblique.
Dude,
you have
I
to
just
be about
think
it.
It's gonna happen. Like, we haven't watched the whole season yet. I feel like something's, there's gonna be at least, here, hot take, bold prediction. There will be at least two references to Spider-Man at minimum in Born Again season two.
That, man, that's the thing. Like, if they, if I were Marvel, that's what I'd be pushing for as like part of whatever deal this is and however that works out financially. Like, obviously Sony is getting the bigger benefit of this financially. And then Marvel gets to use Spider-Man and Avengers things. And that worked very well in the Infinity Saga. But I think that like having the opportunity to like drop him in, man, I mean, it's so crazy. I know people that watched nothing else in She-Hulk but the one episode with Daredevil in it because they were huge Daredevil fans. Like, if in some way they legitimately like had a like a brief cameo or a shot, it would be like it would put so many eyes on this Daredevil show. That would be a massive win for Marvel Television.
Yeah.
I don't think it would happen.
But they don't even have to say anything. I've said this before. If they just cleared the rights that Matthew goes to a crime scene and he stops a couple guys and then he sees three people webbed up to a telephone pole and you see Spider-Man, the back of him, doesn't have to be Tom Holland.
Yeah.
Some stunt actor swinging away. And he's like, oh, there goes that spider guy again. That would be enough for people to be like, oh my gosh, it's incredibly legitimizing this show for them.
No, and to your point, I don't even know, like, would Marvel, again, I'm not going to get into the legal weeds here, but I think that they have the TV rights because we've got your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man happening. We have like Spider-Man show up in like the Marvel Zombies What If stuff. So I think that they can use Spider-Man, and in like Marvel Zombies, it's essentially supposed to be the Tom Holland version of Spider-Man. It's just not Tom Holland voicing him, but they're clearly leaning into that continuity. So I do think, like, if they wanted to be cheeky about it, I think that they could show it. I mean, I don't know. I'm curious. Like, I need to figure out exactly what the dynamics of that deal are. But yeah, I my larger point is, I think that this season is going to have a lot of people asking, where is Spider-Man? So I hope that that's a question that they're prepared to answer in some way.
Totally agree. We'll be right back. All right. So like I said, every time we won't be talking or announcing what these segments are, but just because it's our first time. So we had first impressions, friendly feedback, just following up, and now a segment we like to call From a Friend, where if you are a Friends From Work Plus supporter on Patreon or on Discord, drop us a message and we will respond to that message. Here's the irony. Obviously, we're recording this ahead of time. No one has seen Daredevil yet, so we don't have any messages. But this is where From a Friend will go. So if you want to get into the routine weekly of, you just watched Daredevil, let's say episode 3, oh my gosh, something crazy happened, just shoot us a message. We'll choose a question to respond to in this segment every time from one of our Plus listeners and supporters. The only thing I was going to say here, Robbie, since we don't have a question, is just a reaction to some of the people who have seen the whole show, which is a lot of the reviewers. As we mentioned, you and I had access to the whole show, but we only watched one episode. We just find it more valuable to be weekly, and it limits us from being able to give a overall reaction online to this thing, obviously. But what it does is hopefully creates a unique community from those people where we can help steer the discussion and guide the discussion that's happening amongst the Friends From Work listeners.
Yeah.
Because we also don't know what's going to happen. If we know what's going to happen, it kind of is hard to guide that discussion in good faith.
Well, I'll also say, I think this is the first time that we have had a weekly release show where we've also had Greg putting out a season, you know, a full season review, a written review. So if you are curious for something that's kind of taking the whole season into account, Greg has watched the whole season. He put out a review that was great that is through our newsletter. So if you want to go and subscribe to that, it's free. You get a lot of great like news updates every week. Greg collects like kind of all the entertainment MCU news and beyond, but also some stuff like this where it's really great because we always kind of struggle with that tension of wanting to be able to kind of look at it holistically and be part of that conversation. But also like we feel that we really enjoy doing it week to week with listeners, and it kind of is hard it's hard to show up and talk about one episode when we've actually seen every episode. So this is kind of a nice balance that we've been able to strike. So I would just encourage people to go and subscribe there if you are interested in something like that.
No doubt. All I'll say is that thus far, the reviews have been extremely positive. I've even seen a couple of people who are anti-everything say that this won them over. Like this is, I've seen a couple people, Vincent D'Onofrio said that there's a moment in this show that rivals, if not he thinks tops, the I beat you from season 3 moment. Hmm. That's his claim. I then saw some reviewers say, oh my goodness, he might be right when they watched it. This is the time to get on board because my understanding is this is unbelievable. And the only critique I saw from anybody, the only one, is that the first 3 episodes or 2 episodes kind of start a little slower. And so if this, what I just watched, is the slow, I'm so excited for where this is going because I still thought this was excellent. So that's from a friend. I guess their friends are the reviews that I saw.
Which is a great spot to be in. Man, as a moment, to kind of look at the wider MCU, not continuity wise, but we're recording this in the wake of like a bunch of stuff. We had the Brand New Day trailer come out, which was so good. But also I think today we're getting a lot of new stuff about the Punisher special. I think, did we get a release date for that today?
I saw rumors that it was a full hour long, longer than the other 2 specials.
Yeah, we did. It's May 12th.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so dude, I think this is so all...
That's right on the heels of this.
Yeah, I mean, this is again, thanks to Greg, these notifications have been coming in as we've been recording. But yeah, so we're getting more about that. I do think it's...
That's like right when the finale's airing.
It's the week after, yeah, because I think the finale is May 5th, and then the next week is the Punisher special. And... Mm. So it's like we have that happening. We also yesterday got confirmation that a Wonder Man season 2 is happening.
That's right. That's so great news.
I think it's a fun time to, like, again, it's funny how there are narratives and then there are kind of the actual specific facts. And there has been this ongoing narrative that, like, oh man, you know, Marvel's just not really in its prime. Like, it used to just be like so good. But then when you look at the specifics of what has been coming out,
Thunderbolts,
and what is coming out,
Fantastic Four, Wonder Man, into this season of Daredevil, into Punisher and Spider-Man, Vision Quest, into Doomsday. We've literally never had it better. That's the truth. We just haven't.
It is a crazy streak, and it's just whether people have had a chance to actually watch those things.
That's right.
But man, I love that about Wonder Man, because I think everybody that watched it was so impressed. And again, made me really happy because I loved, like, it was my favorite version of, like, Destin Daniel Cretton that we've gotten. And then now we're seeing him bring that over to Spider-Man Brand New Day. So just a brief moment to say, I think we are like in a real high point right now, which is fun to say.
We're eating good. Our final segment for every review episode is going to end with For the File. We're going to file away our grades on every episode of television. I need to give a little bit of a setup here for the scale, Robbie, and I'm talking to you too, because I think this matters a ton. So I'm going to set this precedent right now.
Yep.
Here's how I do this. I'm really big into lists and ranking. I have ranked every golf course I've ever played. Okay. And the scale that I use is 0 to 10. We're going to use letter grades. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But on a 0 to 10 scale, what I want people to realize is I can't give out tens to anything, because otherwise my mind can't live with this idea. What if I then find something better?
Right.
So, like, in my scale, nothing is a 10. Even Avengers Endgame isn't a 10, because I want to leave this idea that there is something better. So Pebble Beach, the greatest golf course I've ever played, is a 9.7. But I'm not going above that, just because what if I play Cypress Point and it's even better?
Yeah.
I have to leave this idea that there's better. But also, I have to then conversely give low rankings. I need to make the low really low. Otherwise, everything just falls as like a 6 to 7 whenever I'm just mediocre about it. So in our case, I can't say everything is an A minus, because sometimes I need room for there to be an A plus, but that has to be the most rare thing ever. And I need room that some things are like D minuses.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the scale is just a dumb, are you doing an A or a B? Or are you doing a let's go or a let's freaking go? There has to be variation.
No, I agree.
But like my golf thing, I like all golf. I'll play at your Muni. I like all of it. But I have to admit that it's still a 3 out of 10, even though I'm enjoying my experience. There are episodes of television that are just legit a 4 out of 10, even though I still enjoyed it because I like this world and I like the themes and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's the scale. I'm going to be incredibly judicious on when an A is given out in, like, across the board.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say, I mean, in my mind, I think it's helpful for these letter grades to remember that, like, I think a C is an average episode movie, right? Like, I think in a lot of ways, whatever this means, maybe it's like a Protestant work ethic byproduct, but it's like, I think we think of A as the default, and then
it's a total failure.
Right. Like, anything under that is like, oh, you made some mistakes. But I really think it's important to think of like a C as the thing that like you're kind of starting from. And then if it's like great, you start moving up from there. But I don't think that like giving an episode like a C plus should be viewed as us giving it some like horrible grade.
Right. Because like, if you're using numbers with this, you'd say what? An A plus is 97 to 100. A is whatever, 94 to 97. A minus would be 90 to 94, et cetera. Keep moving down. Well, on like a golf scale, if you're in a 9 or above, it's like the most special place I've ever been. One of the very few. I always kind of say like 8 and above, which would be a B minus to an A minus. That range is still like, I will travel for it. Meaning if you have a golf course that's an 8.2, I will fly to you to play it, to be like, I need to experience this in my life. That's how good I still view a B minus, to your point.
Yeah.
So even like a 75, a 7.5 is like, that's a really just kind of good golf course. It's not special, but it's just a really good golf course. So that's the scale we're going to operate on from now on. Okay.
Yep.
So, wow, that's a lot of setup to basically be like, so here's an A plus. I think this is a B. I think this is like an 8.4 out of 10. I'm incredibly intrigued. I would quote unquote travel for it. Like, I am excited. The version of travel for it is I will tell people about it. Meaning Grant and Chris will hear, are you watching Daredevil? From me tonight. That's what an 8.4 is. I'm still going to be like, are you watching this? But was there some sauce to it that's like, oh my gosh, that's like WandaVision episode 8? Is that like, was there some sauce that you say that's like Infinity War? I can't. So again, if that's the scale, Infinity War being an A plus, Infinity War is a 9.7. This is a B to me as far as I'm excited. I think people who just like generic, like good television will like it. I think people who like the Netflix stuff will like it. I think the people who like the MCU will like it. It's kind of a perfect storm, but I think there's room for it to be even better, as mentioned with some of the Karen stuff, and maybe there's not like a ton of sauce yet.
That's funny. I did not do this on purpose, but we're in total lockstep. I was going to say the same thing. And I'm also glad that you gave that preface like ahead of time, because again, it's not just that the grades have to mean something. It's also from the perspective of like, we are like MCU fans that are evaluating MCU projects. So like, that's the context, which is to say, like, we enjoy all of it. So if we can't, the answer can't just be because we are MCU fans, every MCU thing we watch gets an A. Because like, we sort of have to pull out the fact that we are a fan of it, I think, to some degree, if we're going to try to like...
And look, we just spent 70 minutes not pulling the fact that we're a fan out of it, right? Like, that's the whole point. Like, we just indulged our fandom for 70 minutes. But now if I'm being a critic, okay, pull myself out. I think a B is a totally fair... Like, if it has 85% Rotten Tomatoes tonight, I'll be like, that's great.
Yep. Yeah. But I think that's a great place to start. And I think that there have been, like, even episode 8 of season 1 of Born Again was such a huge highlight of that season. And I think of all the Daredevil television stuff that we've gotten. And I have a feeling stuff like that is coming. And so that's part of what I'm like, I view the space above this to be hitting like some of those notes.
Let's freaking go. This is fun again. I want to reiterate this to our podcast listeners. Thank you so much for hanging with us in this drought. To the real ones out there who are listening to this podcast, this is the first project outside of Wonder Man that dropped all at once since essentially last summer. And so officially I can say the drought is over. We're consuming new content live with you. So thank you so much for listening. If you like what you are hearing, consider checking out and supporting Friends from Work Plus by going to Patreon, Spotify, or Apple and subscribing to bonus episodes, including me and Tanner reacting to Project Hail Mary, which is going to be one of the movies of the year.
Oh, nice.
Which Annika and I got to see early. Things like that. I am now watching DTF St. Louis. So maybe I need to do a screensaver episode over there. So those are all things you can find on Friends from Work Plus. But if not, just listening, supporting, subscribing, telling your friends is the biggest help to us. Thank you for doing that. We're truly grateful. And we'll see you next time. Next week, probably Wednesday afternoon, because the rhythm now is going to be Robbie and I watch episode 2 on Tuesday night, record Wednesday morning. I got to edit it, episode out Wednesday afternoon for Daredevil, Born Again. Season 2, episode 2. Thanks. We'll see you next time on Friends from Work.